Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. I want to talk today about kindness. This month's theme, Dharma theme, is kindness and compassion. And I want to talk about mostly about the roots of that in our tradition as I see it. The old word for kindness, it's no mistake that it's kindness and compassion. There's two old words. One is metta and the other was karuna, for kind of that have to do with love and affection in the old school. And those are metta and karuna. Metta is loving kindness, openness, maybe my favorite, friendliness. And in Zen, I've often thought it's so funny the way we get to good in Zen. Because we get to good and things like love and compassion. We get to good by going the wrong direction. By going to beyond good and bad first. So we don't just go to good by saying, be good, be kind. We go first to this place that's beyond, we get to know this place that's beyond good and bad, that's beyond all of our likes and our dislikes, that's beyond love and hate, where we drop all of that. We don't even try to generate any of those things. It's a very strange practice. We give up everything, we give up attraction and aversion. And then what comes up for me, and I think for most people, is a kind of attraction that is not usually felt. I think of it as a weak force. We're surrounded by strong forces all the time. This is a weak, subtle force that we feel when we've dropped everything else. And we could talk about that in a couple of different ways. One is that there is a kind of, first of all, as we're dropping everything, I think there is a kind of attraction to no self, to really letting go of everything. And that's not a kind of attraction that we normally feel. Well, that's one of the reasons we do, take a couple of hours here. It's the reason we do retreats for more than one day. And then when we really have dropped everything as best as we can, we notice that the world just comes to us as it is and is okay, just as it is. And I think there is a kind of attraction to the world just as it is, a warm feeling toward the world just as it is, no matter what it is. In Zen, sometimes we talk about that as us coming together with the world, subject and object coming together. And it's not as if we have to force those things together, we just get ourselves out of the way and they come together. And we can feel, I think, even in just a sit like this, that the energy that we spend to keep things separate from us, that unconsciously we are keeping the world out. We're objectifying the world. And then when we drop ourselves, we allow it in. And it comes to us. So when we see a flower with no mind, then it's just the flower as it is. It's not the flower as beautiful or as ugly. And according to Zen, that's the deepest level at which we can meet the flower and relate to it. It's level zero. It's the most intimate way to experience the world. There's this pretty well-known story about one monk asking another monk. Daizang asked Fayan, "Where are you going?" Fayan said, I'm wandering aimlessly. What do you think of wandering?" asks Daizang. I don't know," Fayan says. Daizang says, "Not knowing is most intimate." And that Fayan was enlightened. These things have happy endings usually. But not knowing is most intimate. Just not knowing leads to this intimate space that I think could be called love. It's a very subtle kind of love when we drop everything. Maybe the subtlest kind of love. But it feels something like that. It feels like, okay. Hakuin says in his Song of Zazen, when you do Zazen just once, all of your crimes are removed. That's how powerful Zazen is. They're all gone. They all wiped away. All beginningless crimes. Well, that's silly, right? But it's not really. It feels like that. It feels like for a time, we're forgiven. All of our sins are washed away, all of the past, and we're okay. I really think of this kind of zone as a zone of amnesty, where for a time everything's okay. We're going to have to go back and answer for those crimes later. But to have the feeling, to have had the feeling that it's okay, changes the way we go back into the world. So, I think when we're practicing and we run into something difficult during practice, the sound of a car comes by when we're just having a nice time enjoying the birds. We can practice just allowing that to be what it is and opening up to love, this very subtle kind of love, letting the car in. Letting it in and allowing it to be just as it is. So, I think, you know, it's, we work at that. We work at that because we're not used to that kind of appreciation or love. It's kind of dangerous, I think, for us, in a way. I mean, that's the way I identify it. It's because it upsets our general sense of self. The way the self normally operates, it kind of threatens the established order. No self does that. Self has established an order and this is good, and the sound of cars is not that great, not definitely not as good as birds, and so we're going for that. So this undermines that established order. I learned that in the 13th century, there was this movement that took hold of that age that was the movement toward romantic love, amour. And, you know, you had the troubadours and that whole movement. So love rather than these arranged marriages that had ruled the day. And the church, you know, they didn't approve of this wild new idea. And the romantics noticed that amour, spelled backwards, is Roma, which is Rome, the church. So they loved that these two things were kind of opposites. And that love has this potential to kind of break us out of our conventions, the institutions, the culture. You know, the Romeo and Juliet story is all about that. Like love cutting through all of these things that we've put up, all these distinctions that we've made. And in our own life, it does that too. This kind of practice. We have to handle it carefully in a certain way because it is disruptive. It is potentially disruptive. So we do it in a kind of a, you know, a nice clean space and so that we can feel it and then come back to ourselves. And by feeling it and coming back to ourselves, we can, I think, integrate those two aspects. So it doesn't have to be a war between amor and Roma, between self and no self. They should get to know each other. They're both needed, they're both useful, and they don't have to fight. And I think the most fundamental thing, really, in our practice is for those two aspects to really get to know each other and to feel comfortable going back and forth with each other, handing off the lead to each other. Because if that relationship is good, it allows the integration and the growth of this love, of this intimacy, and allows it to become, I think, in an unforced way, a kind of predisposition toward kindness, toward compassion. And when it's built on that foundation, it has a broad foundation. It's not narrow. So, you know, and I think there can be a kind of, I mean, I want to be careful here, but I think if we just go out and be good, go out and be kind, without a broad foundation, I think it can be shaky in various ways. And I think if a foundation is laid, good foundation, then I think the love that we give, the kindness that we give, is of a more subtle kind, and also more global. It's toward everything. It's a kind of friendliness habit that forms toward everything that we approach. And it has certain qualities too, which include attention and focus and calm. I think as we come from that state and build that build from that foundation. I think that practices that encourage openness and love and kindness are good. And I think that's one of the things that that a Sangha does. And though it may sound too cautious and bloodless, I kind of believe in building slowly those, building kindness and compassion from that zero state, and not leaping too quickly to love and to kindness. It may sound unloving, but to make love and kindness our mantra, I think, can be a mistake. Rather than let it build from the bottom. Because I think it's possible to get trapped in a kind of idea of kindness, in a kind of idea of love. And then, you know, we become sort of, we're following our idea of it rather than following what we really know as love. And maybe it allows, you know, leads us to be sweet and soft kind of all the time, but not really. I think that can be a trap in Buddhism. Because I don't think that we should be feeling love and kindness all the time, to put a point on it. I think this practice has helped me feel that I'm a more subtle creature than that. That I think our journey has to recognize that we are many things, that we have many energies within us, and respect those energies, and work with them. I just did a retreat on Hakuin. Here's a calligraphy of his. And that bottom calligraphy there, that's joy. And the calligraphy reads, "In joy lie the seeds of sorrow." That's what it says up here. "And in sorrow lie the seeds of joy." And that's the way I was taught, that these opposite energies of joy and sorrow are related, in a similar way to the way that self and no self are related. And that they know each other, that they can hand the lead over to each other without a big fight. That one can sprout and then the other, and that they don't hate each other. And I don't know if this is true of all opposites in the world, but when I was in Norway just now, I made a partial list of ones that are true of me, for me. So self and no self, fast and slow, happy and sad, open and closed, noisy and quiet, calm and excited, forward and back. I am a leader, I am a follower. I'm right, I'm wrong. I have my shit together, I don't have my shit together. Can those things know each other? The having my shit together and not having my shit together. Can we pass the lead over from one to another, or does it have to be a fight? I'm right and I'm wrong. If we can pass the lead over from one to another in a natural and untroubled way, I think it allows us to move through our life more freely. And so it is, I think, with kindness and love. Now, we're going to get into problem with definitions here. But if we define kindness as, you know, in one way, I didn't look up the definition, I probably should have. The opposite might be something like sternness or strictness, or closeness, or maybe even dislike. Something in that word salad. And those are also part of our picture. Those energies, I think, should get to know each other and pass the baton off to each other as needed. Sharon Salzberg, who's a Buddhist teacher, you know, who talks about kindness a lot, and I have to admit, I really wanted to read her book. I have another book of hers that I really like and appreciate. It's very solid and sound. But, of course, kindness is one of her big things. Loving kindness. And she talks about how, as a young woman, she was traveling in a rickshaw through Calcutta, and somebody jumped into the rickshaw with her and, you know, attempted to drag her out. And she was worried. Whoever was with her beat him off with an umbrella. And she asked her meditation teacher afterwards, what should I have done? And he said, oh, Sharon, with all the loving kindness in your heart, you should have taken that umbrella and hit the man over the head with it, your own umbrella. And I think that's sage advice. And I think a case can be made for that, for sure. A case of kind of long-range kindness for the situation, loving kindness and wisdom. But for me also, another way to look at it is that she, rather than her summoning loving kindness, that loving kindness could easily pass the lead over to sternness when needed. And then if she clocked him really hard, back when he's lying on the street there, then maybe hand the baton right back to kindness. I think there can be a danger if you make a god out of kindness or happiness or love, that you make a devil out of the other. And you'll think that you need to be loving, kind all the time. And I think that's bound to lead to trouble, or whatever your idea of loving and kind is. But if you look at that calligraphy, as I said, the biggest character is joy. And Hakuin, for all of his stern practice, for all of his sorrow, especially earlier in his life, loved to laugh. And after his awakenings, he would he was kind of famous for, you know, falling over in the street and laughing or giggling his way, rolling around in the mud. I think this practice does lean toward joy, toward love, toward kindness, toward openness. It leans us toward that. And in order to really know them, I think, and to be able to manifest them in a healthy way, we have to know ourselves completely and all of our energies. So I don't have a grand theory of kindness and love yet, but I think it's complicated. But I do believe in doing Zazen as deeply as we can, opening to the world, to oneself, feeling that subtlest love, and then growing that seed of love as that's found there, which I think is best nurtured in a healthy community. And I also think that it's not perfectly straightforward, that in order to grow up strong and loving, we need a varied diet. We need to get to know all kinds of, all parts of ourselves and be able to work with them as well.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.